Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to Classical Ideas. This is Greg Soden. Something I love about this show is that I have the space to dig into topics and practices with people who have been immersed in them for many years. Documenting these stories and personal experiences of trainings, spiritual practices, traveling, and ideas is truly a thrill and an honor. Today's topic is the koan, defined as paradoxical anecdotes and riddles used in Zen to demonstrate inadequacy of logical reasoning for the purpose of provoking enlightenment. This discussion is told through the lived experiences of my guest, Corey Ichigen Hess, a former Rinzai Zen monk turned body therapist living on Whidbey Island in Washington State. Corey was my guest on episode 80 of this show, when we talked about monastic living and the day-to-day routine of being a Rinzai monk. Corey and I have kept in close contact in the months since we first talked, and we got to talking via email about koan practice, particularly how I found them so confusing. A particular blog entry of Corey's jumped out at me, in which he describes koans. In his November 11th, 2018 entry, titled Describing Traditional Rinzai Koan Practice from his website zenembodiment.com, he writes, quote, "In Zen, after our Zazen meditation has deepened to a certain point, and after we have had a significant breakthrough in our consciousness, we begin to do koans. Koans are little stories, little situations, in which the enlightened masters express and display their states of mind. Through working with these situations, the student's own state of mind is molded to grasp the incomprehensible meaning of the koan." Corey is a good writer. He's good-natured, he's funny, and he's a caring person, and I love his sense of humor. He likens his training in koans to adding an additional gear to his way of seeing the world, adding an energy, a tool, which makes him feel like a wizard in a Muggle world. As always, you can follow this show on Twitter at classical_ideas or support the show on Patreon at patreon.com/classicalideaspodcast. I'd love to hear from you also at classicalideas@outlook.com. So for me, this conversation with Corey was funny, pushed me to understand the mysterious practice of koans, and helped me have a reason to hang out a second time with my friend Corey Hess. You can find Corey online at zenembodiment.com and at coreyhessbodytherapy.com. So without further delay, please enjoy our conversation on koan practice. Corey Hess, thank you so much for coming back on Classical Ideas.
Oh my gosh, thank you for having me. It's such a pleasure. This is exciting. I love having return guests, and I'm delighted that you are coming on the show today to talk about koans. But really quick, for anyone who wants to get into like the nitty-gritty of your life and backstory of you living in a Japanese Rinzai monastery, any listener can go back and check out episode 80 of Classical Ideas, as well as your episode that you did on the show Hess's Heroes, where you discuss a lot of your history. But is there anything you want to say as a way of introducing your practice and your life so you can get the listeners who haven't heard episode 80 kind of like know who you are?
I'm a former Zen monk. I spent my 20s in Japan and in the U.S. in monasteries. And now I'm just a dad here on Whidbey Island in the Pacific Northwest. And I do healing work now as a way to sort of a medium to express some of that in my life. I kind of think of myself as sort of an artist now.
Wonderful. And a writer, I would also like to add.
Right.
So you called being a Zen monk in your blog, Zen Embodiment, you called it like being a primordial energy wizard. What does that mean?
Well, part of that is I'm trying to get the reader in that to realize that Zen isn't kind of just this intellectual exercise that, you know, we've got this where we see Zen is everywhere now, kind of getting your Zen on or relaxing, anything like that. And in fact, the training is much more in this energetic, transformative sort of process. And the practitioner, more and more, it's almost like through this transformation, you start to get in touch more and more with this great life energy. And in that process, it becomes sort of magical. Everything comes alive. You heal. You begin to tap into something very, very powerful.
Excellent. So this unseen energy that Zen monks tap into through months and years of practice, of zazen, of meditation, of work, this is not an intellectual endeavor that, like you said. Is that right?
Right. Right. Exactly.
What should we understand it as being if it's not an intellectual endeavor that we can think ourselves into understanding?
I think a lot of the way that we sort of navigate life is by reaching out with our awareness towards everything, and we try to grasp things. And Zen is primarily about not grasping outwards for anything. And so part of that grasping is to intellectualize things. So I want to understand that. I want to grab that and figure it out. And the Zen really, you know, with the Roshi, he really would make us stop doing that. We had to receive what was happening. We had to engage cellularly with each moment. And that engaging is so very radically different than anything we are used to in our lives.
Okay. So, like this energy,
yes.
Which you have sort of like turned into like a profession, right? Like you work with this energy, you've gone and you've carried this forward into the world outside of the monastery. And you describe in your blog that this energy is almost sort of like the meaning of life to a monk. Is that accurate?
I think it is. And so really this energy is what we're talking about is the source. It's sort of the base of reality. And instead of an idea of reality, instead of a thought, we're actually trying to engage with the energy of this very moment. And that is a cellular process. It's a process of becoming what's happening over and over. And again, that's so radically different. But so that's not something you can think about. It's something that, you know, it's like we learn to feel and grab the moment and experience it in a way that's very powerful.
Okay. So
my life, yeah, I'm out here is I took a lot of that training, and I wanted to express that. I wanted to help people with that engagement, and I wanted to communicate. And so part of my life is communicating about this great kind of love affair with reality. And how to, for me, I found that if I would really engage with that, that I would heal, that I would become happy, that instead of me being at odds with reality, instead of me feeling that perhaps the world was against me in some way, I found that if I could engage with what was happening, that I would become one with it. And then that would be great joy would come from that.
Did you always have a sense that this energy existed in the world even before you became a monk? Is this something that has been consistent throughout your life, or was this a development that kind of like smacked you over the head only after beginning practice?
Well, I think that usually one comes to this sort of intense practice because you're running up against yourself and reality. And, you know, physically or health-wise or, you know, they talk about this notion of what's called the great doubt. And that is kind of this fundamental feeling that something's not right. Something's, you're not fitting with what's happening. And you need to realize some truth to understand how to become one with, like, reality. And so for me, I think I was always feeling like I knew possibilities were out there for, you know, engaging with life, but I wasn't sure how to get there. So I think in a way it's both. It's both that you know you got somehow you have a sense of our own, everyone's true nature, and yet you know that, so you need to realize it. You need to fulfill it. And so that was real strong with me.
Excellent. Okay, so I just kind of want to see if I if there's a misconception out there about this energy that you're talking about. Is this similar to what is known as Tao at all?
I think that all of these this is the source of the base of everything. Mm-hmm. And so all of the different, you know, philosophies or religions, I think personally that those are all cultural additives onto what is base. So for me, like, it's not really interesting to think of something which is, that someone created this. That's not actually that interesting. It's more what's the base of everything. And so I would think the Tao is the same. I would think that a Sufi master perhaps would be engaging with the same thing slightly differently through a cultural lens. So that's more interesting to me than what someone, you know, thought out.
Okay, gotcha.
That makes sense?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, this is all a great mystery to me that I'm wrestling with myself. You know? That's why I love talking to you about this kind of stuff, because I am genuinely perplexed on many of these issues. So, you have written that Zazen has to deepen to a certain point, and that some kind of breakthrough occurs within Zazen before you can begin a koan practice. Is that accurate?
Well, in my tradition, it really was. And I feel that, there is an initial koan called the breakthrough koan.
Okay.
And this, in my tradition, this is the mu koan.
Okay.
I didn't start doing that for a couple of years. So I was sitting on the cushion learning to breathe, learning to deepen my, you know, samadhi, learning to engage with my zazen. And that was a hard process for me, really hard. And so in a way it was good. It took me a long time to be able to really engage with this. And then you get this initial koan, and that's a breakthrough koan. And that for me was the mu, and that was completely transformative for me. And then that breakthrough koan, it's like it's a key which opens your consciousness to be able to engage with this other stuff, okay, and engage with these other masters, okay, and so You can do koans, I think, but unless you can really deeply engage with this wisdom, then you're not really going to touch it and really experience it.
Okay, so this is brand new to me. Why do novice or brand new monks, why do they not get koans? Why is this like a practice that you didn't get for a couple of years? What's the justification behind that?
So part of it is that when you first start sitting, it takes about a year of sitting a lot to really even be able to really engage with Zazen. It takes a long time, and that's good, you know. And then as your concentration or whatever you want to call it, if your samadhi deepens, then you can go to a really profound place in your sitting. And then from there, you're in this open place. Then from there, you can receive the teachings of this koan, this breakthrough koan. And then later after that, you're also always sitting in this deeper samadhi to work with these koans. Of course, you work with them in your daily life also, but it takes that deeper level of sitting to be able to engage with these.
How did you know, or how did your teacher know that you were ready to receive your breakthrough koan, the Mu koan?
Well, the Roshi is so incredibly skilled in this. A lot of what we're dealing with, again, is this. There are different words for it. There's ki, which is a form of, it's like a energy flavor, or there's kyogai, which is a particular. Particular type of energy, and the Roshi is very aware of all of this. He can feel where you are when you walk in the room. He knows what your state of consciousness is. That's how it works. So for him, he can see. He's seen me 1,000 times. We do a private interview. It's called Sanzen. He's seen me develop and deepen, and go from being a really awkward, frightened, scared. person, to kind of learning how to engage with life in a really deep way. So he knows, he can feel it.
Nice. So in very basic terms, for folks out there listening who may not know anything about what we're talking about, what is a koan?
So a koan, for me, it's like a little story. It's a little story from the past. It's a little what they call it, an old case, I think. And really, it's this little situation that happened between a master and maybe a student. And that situation displays the master's freedom, their freedom in their everyday life. Their huge state of mind is displayed through this little situation. That's what a koan is. And so you have to engage with this koan. Often you'll get the koan and you don't know what it is. You don't know what the question is. You don't know what you're supposed to do with it. And so your job is to engage with that.
Okay. Can you give me an example of like a very introductory koan that people would receive early in their training?
Well, the famous one that everyone knows is what is the sound of one hand clapping? That's very famous. That's Hakuin's famous. So that would be his breakthrough koan would be that, what is the sound of one hand clapping? And I did, the monk asked Joshu, does a dog have the Buddha nature? And replied, moo. So that was mine. And so you get this and you think, what am I supposed to do? But this one with the moo koan, actually, you hear every day while you're waiting to go see the Roshi, you hear people yell moo.
Yeah.
Over and over, you're hearing this yell. And so by the time I was ready to do this breakthrough koan, I knew I was going to be yelling this moo. And then when I was on the moo koan for a long time, 6 months, I wasn't yelling. I was just engaging with it. And then at a certain point, the Roshi asked me to express it. And I want to say a little bit about this. So what you're doing is – it's like this process starts to unfold within you, and this energy again starts to overflow from your experience. And the moo, the shouting of the moo, is this expression of this cup overflowing. So it's not an angry thing. It's not a, it can be angry, but it's not an angry thing. It's more that you're expressing this profound full and tautness.
Okay. So you get your koan, right? And and you go away and you have the koan. So yeah. Say it's like day one of having your koan. What do you do? Like, as you're in zazen, or if you're in the kitchen cooking, or if you're cleaning, what's going on with the koan in your mind?
So I want to say, this is kind of interesting, but two different ways this works for me. With the first one, the mu koan, it's a little bit like a mantra.
Okay.
So you're saying mu all day long, mu, 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 and you're breathing mu, and every time you breathe, it's mu. And then after a couple months, like all of a sudden you're dreaming about mu. Mu is all you wake up and you say mu. Okay. You just, it's coming out. And then the birds singing is mu. And then everything becomes mu. You're having tea and you accidentally say mu. And you start to just become totally immersed in this until everything becomes mu. And there's no division between anything. And part of what happens in that process is that you start to transform through that. It's this way to bring oneness to you and to experience oneness with everything. Okay. And so that's what the first one's like. So after you've gone through the process, that first one, then you're engaging later with other koans. It's a little different because you have a different sense you have a different connection with it. So the koan is very, it may be very elusive, but you have that key. There's a part of you that knows how to engage with it. So a good example of a koan might be, let's see, what's the true person of no rank or something like this, Rinzai's koan. And you have to engage with that, and you don't know how to. You don't know what you're supposed to do. And for me, For me, the process was, are we doing okay, Greg?
Yeah, we're great.
So for me, the process it's very confusing. You don't know what you're supposed to do. You part of you jumps on back to your wannabe mental. You want to say, oh, I'll figure this out. I'll bring in this great answer to the Roshi and I'll knock his socks off, you know, and I'll be cool and I'll show him my enlightened state of mind. And, you know, you're kind of thinking, I'll come up with a good answer. And in that you're reaching out, you're saying, I'm going to find something and I'm going to give it to him. And he hates that. That's just, he won't let you do that.
Well, and you're intellectualizing as well.
You're intellectualizing the answer. So you think, maybe I'll just be a little tricky. And I'll fool him into thinking I'm not being intellectual. You know, and you take it in and you enter the room and he knows. He can feel where you are, okay? And so the koan is, it's like a door within you opens. And you don't know how that door opens, but for me, through engaging with this, okay, so if Rinzai was, if I was going to do a koan with Rinzai, I would begin to feel Rinzai's state of mind, and I would begin to engage with that. And for me, it was sort of like a cellular process of, I'm going to become this cellularly, and I would feel almost like I was interacting with Rinzai. And so I would take that in, and I would have no idea what I was going to do. And then through that, the Roshi would see, oh, you're transforming through this. So you're becoming this state of mind.
Oh, wonderful.
So it's not about grabbing. It's about all of a sudden you're Rinzai. You walk in and you're Rinzai.
Yeah. It's very mysterious, it sounds like.
Yes, mysterious.
Yeah. It sounds like you don't have it all figured out yourself, even though you've practiced this for a long time.
No way. So just to say, we think, part of us, we think, oh, I'm going to figure this all out. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get to the point where I'm like, boy, I got this all dialed in. You know, this is all clear. And in fact, the Roshi, he takes you. You think, oh, I'm going to, like I said, I'm gonna be a little bit open-minded, and then I'm going to figure it out, or I'm going to not know, and then I'm going to figure it out. But he makes you go into this, I don't know, and then like 100 times more.
So,
yes.
So it sounds like there's not a single right answer to a single koan. Like, it sounds like there might be many right, quote-unquote, right answers, depending on different people at different times in different contexts.
I think there are right answers, but you know, the Roshi can see your state of mind, and so I think that is actually the most important thing. So you may not give the exact right answer, but if you're bringing in that state of mind, that's the right answer.
Okay, so because I mean, anybody can go on Google and look up historically delivered answers to koans.
Right. In I think this is part of it that. If you brought in the right answer and your state of mind was wrong, then you're wrong, right? So yeah. He won't let you do that, right?
Okay. So even if you get it right, you can still get it wrong when you use logic to answer it, or when you've like come in with the wrong state of mind to answer it, when the Roshi can tell that you're sort of like just like, you know, inauthentic or phoning it in or not in the moment.
Yes, and you know, this is it's a big process. You're dealing with someone training for years. And, you know, the Roshi, part of what the koan really is that the Roshi is like a blacksmith, and he's molding the students. So he's seeing, this is what's really going to help this person right now to open up, to go further into their, basically integration of their awakening, right? So if he can see, oh, this is going to really open up this person in this certain corner of their consciousness, he's going to work with you in that way. And then he may move you on to something else that will open you up. So it's very creative in that way. So yes.
So on your blog, you wrote that when the Roshi tells you not to use your brain when you are wrestling with a koan, how can newcomers or new practitioners make sense of that? Like, how do you get to the point to where you can stop using your brain to solve it?
Yeah. I think that the main point is to learn to deeply do zazen. Okay. And the koans are really just a fruition of this deep zazen. Right. So the way we need to really deeply engage with zazen is feeling our bodies, feeling internally what's happening. We need to spend a lot of time on the cushion, really engaging with the energy that circulates through our body. So the koans, they're really a fruition of something else, which is deeper.
Okay. So I've watched, I've watched a lot of videos of, you know, footage in monasteries, a lot of the footage in the documentary that you and I spoke about on episode 80 that deeply dissected sort of like a day-to-day life within your monastery that you lived in. And in that documentary, there's a scene where a monk screams at the Roshi in response to a koan. And what I want to know is, does the person really scream in the moment because it was uncontrollable, or does someone scream because they feel like screaming is the right answer?
Well, I know that video, and those were both. Those were kind of normal answers. Okay. And in that really loud scream in that was the moo.
Okay.
So that's an expression of this energy. And that's that monk's particular flavor of doing that. And it's different for different people. But so those people are not necessarily going in angry and frustrated, and so making a shout. That's more that they're trying to express. The first one, you know, they're expressing a sharp state of mind for an answer to the koan. So there is theater. I would say there is some theater, but it's more that they, if they're really doing that, that's an overflowing. It is. Now I have in my sanzins in the past, I have screamed and I have gotten very mad and I have cried and I've hit things, you know, and you do, it's a wild scene, you know?
Yeah.
Those were pretty normal sanzins on that video. Yes.
Okay. So after you answer a koan to the Roshi and the Roshi sends you away for not getting it quote unquote correct, like what goes through your mind when you leave the little building where you had your sanzen? Like, is it motivating? Is it dispiriting? Does it strengthen your Zen practice to be sent away repeatedly over time?
Yeah, it really strengthens it. You know, you're always wrong. You're always wrong. It's a duel that you do with the Roshi, and every time he wins the duel, and you're wrong, and so you go and you're kind of like, I'm gonna get that bastard, you know, you're pissed off, yeah, but at the same time, with the Roshi in sanzen, there is an energetic transfer that happens. So usually after sanzen, you're pretty pumped up, you feel pretty good actually. So there's like an under the table kind of synchronicity of energy that happens. So you leave feeling kind of like you can take on, often you can take on the world. But yeah, he definitely, he make you wrong. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So Corey, you're like one of the, like the cheerful, most cheerful people that I've come across. And you have this amazing blog entry, and I don't remember exactly how you phrase it, but it's like standing in the corner laughing.
Yeah, right.
And so when you just said, you're always wrong, I then pictured you standing in the corner laughing about just always being wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, so what's like the life lesson for you of like always being wrong?
Yeah, it's that you can be really happy no matter what. That's it. That's what Zen life is like in the monastery, is that it sucks. It's awful. You know, you're really cold. You know, you got no clothes on. You know, you don't have a hat on. You're bald. You know, you're having to live this life where you get up at in the middle of the night, 3 o'clock every day. You go to bed at 11 and yet something starts to transform that makes you happy for no reason. And you know that good and bad, you know, they start to be less important while something begins to fill you up. And so that's part of what happens with the zazen deepening, and then the mu, and then these koans, is that the Roshi can find a way to show you through all that, that you still have this place within you that's unbreakable. There's a joy which can't be pushed down. So that's it. Yeah.
Nice. And you wrote in your blog as well that you don't really like pass a koan, like you pass a test, but you sort of pass through a koan. Is it sort of like, so I'd imagine like if I'm writing a novel or I'm doing a piece of art, I can work on that novel or that art for the rest of my life. But you get to a point to where you're just kind of like done editing or done painting, even though you could work on it for years and years and years. You just get to a point to where it's done. Is it kind of like that, like getting to a point to where it's like, yeah, here I am?
Yeah, I think that it's a process, and you go through a process with it. And then often, to be honest, the Roshi then sees, okay, you kind of done enough with this process, and now I'm going to, like I said, he's going to become the blacksmith slightly differently on your process. So we don't pass koans. The Roshi tells you when you're done, for one thing.
Okay.
It's not like, I feel like I'm over that one. You know, people are on koans for 30 years, the same ones, you know? So, and I think, you know, to be quite frank, I think that this training is very hard, and I think the Roshi is also trying to keep people really motivated. So if you give them something else to work on, that they've been there 15 years, they need some more juice to work with.
Okay. So after you finish a koan, when the Roshi tells you you're done with a koan, the concluding piece is that you then have to find a piece of poetry, correct?
Right.
So tell me about this. What's up with the poetry?
There's a book called Zen Sand, and Victor Sogan Hori edited that. He's a former McGill professor, and he's a really wonderful guy. And so these capping phrases, jaku go, and Roshi would say, you know, bring in a go, you know, based in Japanese, you know. And so then you have to, so he's kind of like, oh, you suck, but okay, now bring in a poem, you know, to say, you know, to further the enigma, you know, into this. So you found there's some place within you which opened, and you don't quite understand that. And then to do the capping phrase, you go further into that world of not knowing, and you're looking through this book. You know, it's kind of like one horse, no rider above, no horse below, stuff like that. You know, you don't know what to make of it.
And
you're through this book, you know, a thousand different little poems like this. And it's like you're wading around in the dark, in this unknowing, and you don't know what you're looking for. You don't have a clue how to find it. But again, there's some kind of connection that happens through this process. And it's like you touched upon some connection. And so doing the capping phrases, you know, there's no time in the monastery. So you're up at 2 a.m. looking through this book, or everyone else is in Sanzen, and you ran somewhere to look through this book really fast. And you're kind of like, you know, freaking out because you got to go see him and you got to give him an answer. And he's going to laugh at you because you're wrong. So, and you want to be right. You want to get it. So it's very exciting. So you're going through this book, and something starts to transform. Something changes through you, and then you come upon one, and it really hits you in this very strange way. It's like you could break out in sweat, or your brain kind of changes. Your awareness shifts. And so then you see, oh, that did something, that changed me somehow. And so you take that one in, and you don't necessarily know why that one was transformative, but you take it to him, you know, and he kind of looks at you and says, not very good, you know, but one more, bring in another one, you know. And so you do that, and you keep going through this process of refining, searching without knowing how to search. It's very beautiful. You know, again, the Alice in Wonderland, the rabbit hole goes deeper and deeper. You think you got it figured out, and you go deeper and deeper. And so with these capping phrases, it's like that. You're living in this mysterious world of unknowing. You have no idea what's going on. You still know how to cook rice and shovel and rake, but you're in this mysterious world of dealing with these this unknowing. So you take one in finally, and he says, okay, good enough. Not right, but good enough. You
know? Yeah. Okay, so one of the things I'm really curious about is sleep in monasteries. Yeah. Because as far as I can tell, it's not healthy to sleep 4 hours a night. And so I know in a monastery you only sleep 4 or 5 hours a night. And does that sleep deprivation do something that is beneficial to the practice? Like, does it help you detach from the logical mind and assist in koan solving? What is the role in this extreme lack of rest in the practice?
I think it does take you out of your head in a certain way. Yes. But I would also say that because you're sitting so much, sitting is about half the rest as sleeping. So if you're sitting a minimum of 8 hours a day, you're getting recharged. And part of the deal with the monastery is that, you know, we normally work through our lives on a particular type of, you know, again, energy, but through this zazen, you begin to discover this other way of being, which it fills you up, and so you're energized in a different way. You're not relying on the same type of functioning and energy that you would normally. So you feel good.
Okay.
I mean, partly. You also feel exhausted, and you every morning you wake up swearing. But yeah, you feel good in a certain way.
Okay.
Yeah.
Have you continued that, like, after you've gotten out of the monastery? Like, do you still sleep sparingly, or have you completely adjusted your sleep in the years since?
I'd say somewhere in between.
Okay. Are you like a 6 hour a night kind of person?
Maybe. Yeah. I really, I have a lot of people. I have three daughters. So
yeah.
Sometimes I'm just taking a little time.
Yeah.
You know, I'm up in the middle of the night cause I'm doing my zazen, you know, or something. Cause I'm, watching Barbie or something. You know what I mean?
Cool. So, yeah. So one thing I used to do in my classroom is I would do like a Zen day in my high school class where students would actually receive a koan, and we would sort of like set up the classroom to where there were no chairs in the room. There were just like cushions everywhere. Students had to like sit and stare at the wall and like have their koan. And so I would give them koan selections like, who is facing me? How has your health been in recent days? And what is the highest meaning of the holy truths? What springs to mind when you hear about high school students receiving a koan?
Well, I think that's wonderful. I think it's wonderful. I'm all for having people break out of their normal way of thinking reality works. You know, for me, it's very exciting to think, you know, it's as if the whole world is going, you know, forward and you go backwards and to see what's real. And I think in some ways that's what they're doing. Personally, when I hear those kind of koans, I hear that I actually begin to kind of engage and feel like Bodhidharma. You know? Like I could like, it's like this expansiveness starts to take over, you know? So I think it's wonderful. Yeah.
What do you think that like koans like that have to offer to the young people in our country today?
Well, I think that zazen and meditation they're extremely powerful. And I think that, again, this is all just kind of realizing what's real, engaging with reality, melding with what's happening. I think that this is totally invaluable. I just think it's the most amazing thing. And I think if we can get anyone to engage with that more, that's wonderful. And then I think the koans would be, again, a deeper way of fruition of dealing with that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. So we kind of talked about this earlier. We touched on it, but I'm curious if you have more to say on it. What have been some like long-term impacts of having a sustained koan practice? How has this molded you and stuck with you for life?
Yeah. Well, again, I feel like part of what the Zen does is it gives you this connection with this source, with this true nature. And instead of needing to look outside for guidance, instead of needing to grasp something, the Zen training, it allows you to engage with your own process and to have your own connection with that. So that's really what's interesting to me these days is exploring that, engaging with that, and sharing that with people. I feel like, I deeply healed and transformed through my training. And so for me, a lot of it is about offering that to others and figuring out how can I be of service? How can I be a light to others who maybe don't know how to quite engage with their own process, with their own energy, if you want to say, with reality. So for me, it's healing. It's mind expanding. It's, yeah.
If you think about yourself, like before you went into the monastery for years and years and did sustained monastery monastic practice, zazen work, how do you think your personality would be different if you had never done koan practice in the monastery?
Either I'd be dead, which is possible, because I feel like for me, I needed to figure out this connection. I really profoundly felt at odds with reality. Okay, and so if I hadn't been a Zen student, I would be probably wearing some other weird spiritual clothes. Of, you know, I'd be a hardcore Sufi, you know, or I'd be, you know, I'd be living in some Trappist place or something, you know, or whatever. I think for me, I had to. I got lucky enough to find a teacher who was, I always like to say this, that for me, it wouldn't have mattered if they were a car mechanic or, you know, a used car salesman or a Sufi master. If they would have been the one who could guide me through this process, I would have gone with them. But the Roshi just was the right karmic connection for me.
You've kind of alluded to several different religions and spiritual practices throughout this conversation. I'm just curious, like, do you like dabble in other things? Like, do you have interests that are beyond Zen? Like, what are you into?
Well, I love religions. I love, you know, I love Hafez. I love, you know,
yeah.
This joke, you know, our friend always talks about Rumi Zen. So we love, you know, mixing these things and enjoying these. You know, honestly, this is all for me. It's about a wholesale connection, you know, and there are a lot of dealers, you know, a lot of different forms this takes, and that's so beautiful. But so I like looking at, you know, different religions for sure. But for me, what I'm into is I'm still just trying to take away everything. I just find that very profoundly interesting. Like when I'm walking on the beach, I'm trying to discover what is, again, deeper and deeper. What is it that's moving? What is it that's prior to any idea, any philosophy? That's I'm so fascinated by that.
That training is like burned into you now, isn't it?
Yeah. It's like, you know, if you bleed, it comes out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The Zen bleeds out, you know?
Yeah. Like you're not in the monastery anymore, but it's like still in you. And like, you couldn't get rid of it even if you wanted to.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do sit, I sit. And I find that to be, really necessary. Actually, when people go into this type of process, you can't stop. It's not like you can just quit, because actually your body and your whole self it needs to keep processing things, keep deepening. It's a whole process.
Nice. Well, yeah. Corey, this has been really awesome. I'm like just thrilled to talk about koans with you, because as I've mentioned to you in email before, this is like truly mysterious stuff that I am genuinely perplexed on, and it's really validating for me as well, because, you know, I've read a lot about this and I feel like I've intellectualized it by reading books on it, but this is super helpful for me to kind of see what more there is to it.
Yeah
it's, and it scares me.
Yeah, I hear you.
It's scary. No, stuff.
It's so so much further, so much deeper than we are ready for. And that's for me, that's so exciting. It's so beautiful. You know, again, you know, I think most of us are trying to kind of, it's like we're trying to walk over this line and we're trying to find the answer. If we can just walk over that line, that's a skillful way of being in this world. And we'll go and we'll grab that answer. And I feel like with Zen, they make you suspend that, and you have to walk backwards. You have to walk backwards away from this skillful, you know, maybe perhaps manipulative way of being, and go backwards into the unknown. I find that so powerful and interesting.
Corey, where can listeners find you? Because I know that people will want to read your writing, because you write eloquently on these issues and you genuinely wrestle with things on the page. So where can we find your work?
Well, I have this blog called zenembodiment.com. And I hope I've done some justice to it today, but with the written work, I can edit it.
Yeah. Well,
yeah,
I outlined this entire topic of conversation just from one blog entry on koans that you wrote. So there's a lot there. Your blog is a really cool and accessible and mysterious repository of writing that people can kind of wrestle with and wrap their brains around.
Well, thank you. And any questions on that blog too, I'm happy to wrestle with the reader. And, again, this is a way to, engage with and help people. So that's part of why I'm doing it.
I love it. Well, Corey, I'm sure that I'll have you back on for part three sometime on the show. So thank you so much for spending this time with me today. I am so grateful to have you back on.
Oh, thank you so much, Greg, and it was really my pleasure.
Classical Ideas is produced by me, Greg Soden. Music on Classical Ideas is composed and performed by Derek Strybig. You can find his music at www.wearewarmmusic.com. If you like this show, please rate it on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can email me at classicalideas@outlook.com or find me on Patreon at patreon.com/classicalideaspodcast. Thanks so much for listening.